being a female, I wasn't hanging with the guys. And mostly everybody that worked at my club at that time was a male. I mean, there were very few women when I first started. I could count them on one hand.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. Business today is having an awakening, and it's long overdue. Leaders are finally talking about the importance of diverse workforces, and investors are finally seeing the importance of supporting a diverse range of founders. That's not to say everyone's doing a great job of it. And certainly, if you look back at the stories of some of the most groundbreaking women and people of color in business, you'll see an insane uphill battle that was part business and part personal. And that's true even in the comedy world, where things aren't always as funny as they are on stage. This is why today I want to talk to Caroline Hirsch. Maybe you don't know her name, but you know the people whose careers she's launched. Chappelle, Tracy Morgan, Seinfeld, the list goes on and on. And she did it at what has become the most famous comedy club in the world, Caroline's Comedy Club in New York City's Times Square. She started it 35 years ago, long before Me Too, when the business of comedy was dominated by men. The comics were mostly men, and pretty much all the business executives calling the shots were men. What were the challenges she faced? And how did she navigate the obstacles required to get Caroline's off the ground? That's what I wanted to know. So I headed down to where else? Caroline's Comedy Club, to speak with the woman herself about how she built the most iconic venue for stand-up comedy in the world. Our conversation is coming up after the break. You all know me as the host of How Success Happens, but I'm also an entrepreneur. So that means I give all types of business presentations. And if I don't deliver, my business doesn't grow. It's that simple. That's why I use CrashPlan to back up my work. CrashPlan lets me get my files anywhere, anytime, like, hey, my entire interview was done at night and I woke up to find out my external hard drive left with my wife. Or my entire cup of coffee got knocked over onto my keyboard, but my deadline didn't change. The reasons to get CrashPlan are literally endless. They don't place limits on the file sizes, external hard drives are covered at no additional cost, and I can access my files from anywhere, anytime. So wherever you're listening to this podcast, you could get your backups. Visit CrashPlan.com/howsuccesshappens to start your free 1 month trial today. Again, CrashPlan.com/howsuccesshappens. And now on with the show. We're back. So how did Caroline Hirsch become successful with the odds so stacked against her? To hear the story, we settled in at a table at Caroline's, and I started the conversation by asking her if she really understood the odds that she faced as a woman in the 1980s opening a comedy club. And she said this.
Funny you ask me that. In what this phase we're going through right now with the Me Too movement and Time's Up, you know, I never realized probably there were so many obstacles that I did have, but it never focused in my brain because when I got out of school, it was like, oh, you can do anything you really want to do. So it was just carrying on. But look, if I were a guy, I would have been hanging out with many more people. And you know, when you hang with people, you get a lot of things done outside of going to agents and managers.
Right.
So that was a little different. Being a female, I wasn't hanging with the guys. And mostly everybody that worked at my club at that time was a male. I mean, there were very few women when I first started. I could count them on one hand that it worked for me. But in these years right now, I'm finally realizing, oh, well, maybe it was an obstacle, but we overcame that. And I don't think that women should ever be focused on that. They should just carry on and just have a vision and just go for it.
Sure. I mean, you have to. And I think we're seeing a lot of that nowadays, especially with the Me Too movement. But when you started the club, I mean, we're going back to the early 80s. And I mean, that just had to have been a completely different setup. And you're this woman starting this cabaret at first that you made into a comedy club. Were there certain instances or certain things you recall that you could say really was like, wow, this is going to be hard to do as a woman?
No. Not as a woman, I think as any other person. I think what we started there was, I was onto this idea about all of the young observational humor that was coming through. It was the time when David Letterman went on at 12:30 at night. He was introducing a lot of young comics to the world. And we kind of piggybacked on that when I hired Jay Leno and Jerry Seinfeld, and they'd go onto David's show and they'd say they were at Caroline's, and that gave us this national movement around the country, and Caroline was recognized as this place to go for great comedy that you see on TV.
Sure.
And that's basically what we do here. It's basically the people that appear at this club are basically people that are on TV and movies and whatever and have, you know, have paid their dues. They're not really beginners that are here. Do we have those kind of nights? We have our new talent night, which where we introduce people that we really believe in and think that they're going to go on to great places in the comedy business.
Yeah. So when you were starting, though, and let's say initially with Letterman and Leno, I mean, those are some of the biggest names in comedy. But at the time, were they who they were, who they are now? And like, how did you know, you know, do you have an eye for talent? How did you know to get them up there and put them on stage?
Oh, it's, you know, you watch something on TV or you watched a concert and you just said, you know, this person has that thing, and they did have that thing and they carried through. And, you know, I have to just tell you that Caroline's, I believe, was very responsible for where comedy is today. I really tried to elevate that art form more than anybody else. As you can see from the club here, and this club has been in existence for 25 years.
Yeah, we're actually we're sitting right here. We're at Caroline's. I'm literally like 2 feet from the stage, and it's pretty cool to be in this iconic club and sitting here right now.
27 years old. So, you know, we did this 27 years ago, and it still looks pretty contemporary. And you know, we use the Harlequins as a suggestion of comedy as opposed to a brick wall. And I've always tried hard to present the best people here that I could ever do. And I think that I was in the forefront of the creation of all of the comedy channels. You know, it was the Comedy Channel and Ha.
Yeah.
And then they both merged and it became Comedy Central.
Well, you started a special, right, that was on A&E and that had a pretty good run, Caroline's Comedy Hour, basically. And I know that grew out of that start of Caroline's becoming super popular. So, like, when you started the business and you know, some of those names coming on stage, was it a success right off the bat? Did you catch that wave, like you said? And, like, were people lining up outside the door? Because, you know, starting a business and a club, it's Caroline's today, but was it Caroline's right off the bat, or did it take you some time to really get going?
It took a few months to get going. I'll tell you what.
A few months. That's great.
Well,
I wish I had a business that took a few months to get going.
We had that cabaret thing going, but it just wasn't quite hitting it. It just, cabaret was kind of for an older clientele, and we were like in our 20s, and we wanted to relate to, you know, our contemporaries at that time. So I went out and I tried to get what I really liked and what I really saw around. So I'll give you an example of a turning point. We had Jerry Seinfeld, we had Jay Leno, and then I went out and one of the agents from APA was sitting in the audience one night and I said, do you know who represents Pee Wee Herman?
Oh yeah.
And he goes, why do you ask? We do. And I said, well, I'd really love to have him at the club. And he said, well, he doesn't really have an act, but let me see what I'll talk to him. So as it goes, Paul, then Pee Wee Herman, created this act to bring to the club on 28th Street, which was our first club. So he comes, and we are totally sold out every show, where you had Andy Warhol showing up. I mean, you had this electric group of New York people coming out to see
him. What year was that?
I believe that was 83 or 84.
And that's where he started that whole Pee Wee Herman act that he really took to, like, I remember he made films and he became Pee Wee Herman.
He had Pee Wee's Playhouse, which was on HBO. Like I said, Caroline's always brought talent that really was on TV at the time. And he had an HBO special. And we convinced him to come up with an act to do, which later went on to other agents around the city, and other talent producers saw him. And then he went on to do other bigger shows. And that's where he got Pee Wee's Playhouse.
Right.
Because the producers saw him at my club. And that's where they came up with that idea.
Yeah, it's too bad you can't cut yourself in on all these deals that must have come about here.
His first movie, which was Pee-wee's Great Adventure.
Yeah, I remember watching that movie.
We had worked on that, and I was going to invest in that movie and help with it. And then all of a sudden, Warner Brothers kind of like took it over, or his manager took it over, and I kind of like, I wasn't involved in the project. And, you know, Paul said, well, I have this, you know, this great new director, which was Tim Burton. It was the first movie Tim Burton directed.
You're like, who's this guy?
So, you know, this has been a learning experience for me also, because I was involved in talent so early on. I really get to recognize what works. And that's something that in my other careers and my other companies follows through to.
Sure. So going back to Caroline's and that beginning and Leno and Letterman, when was it when you really knew you were hitting your stride? And, you know, who were some of the other comedians that you brought in after them that, hey, you had this first crop kind of, but then all of a sudden you had who that, you know, all of a sudden the business was booming?
We had a little unknown on Sunday night, Larry David, doing sketches because he worked on Saturday Night Live and none of his sketches were ever picked up. So he did them on Sunday night at the club. You got everybody to come over and they would reenact some sketches that he came up with.
Now, did he go up on, because it's really funny, this weekend I was actually just reading Howard Stern's book, and he has the Seinfeld interview, and in there Seinfeld says, Larry David, Seinfeld was this great stand-up comedian, but Larry David, he basically said he wasn't that great on stage.
Larry would blame the audience.
That's so Larry David.
It's what you see is what you get with him. It's really, really very true. But he's the mastermind of coming up with what comedy really is. It's the simple little element and how they just twist it around it. It's the simplest things that we laugh at.
Well, you know, see it with Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Because it all happens to us. It all happens to us. So that's his brilliance.
Yeah. So then the business, you go from cabaret, you go to comedy. Mm-hmm. And then what happens where all of a sudden it becomes, you know, Caroline's? Was it just a slow progression of just night after night selling out or finding new talent? How did you do it?
Well, here we were working with every young new comedian coming up the ranks. You know, we had Gary Shandling when he was hosting The Tonight Show. Billy Crystal got his remake because he was at Caroline's. We had to convince him to do a week there. So he does a week there, and the people from SNL come in, and then they hire him, and then he explodes again.
It's incredible.
So because he really wasn't doing much after he was on soap and got passed over for SNL, then they put him on, and then he was brilliant on SNL. So over the years, and then we get to A&E coming to me.
Okay, so they actually found me. You. What had they? So what year was this?
That was in 1988, 89.
Okay, so it's only not that long after you really launched the club, and they're coming to you, and what do they say?
So Nick DeVos, who was then running A&E, came to me and said, we have a stand-up show on, but we'd like another one, and we'd like one based in New York so we could watch what's happening, and we want to be involved in the production. So we entered into a agreement with them. We produced Caroline's Comedy Hour, and there was a young woman there at A&E at that time, Abby Raven, who then went on to run the channel years later, who was my account executive on the show.
They all start at the bottom.
We all started, you know, they started working on this comedy show, and then she goes on to run A&E Lifetime and, you know, is still there running everything. And we had the show, and we did something a little different. We were doing these sketches. So we enlisted to be producers and writers on the show. Michael Patrick King, John Stewart, Mike Royce. Now, these are all
the
names.
Young John Stewart. How'd you find him? He was doing stand-up.
John was doing stand-up at that time. And he was getting into writing at that point. I think John was about 28, 29 years old. When I met him down at the Seaport. And we started doing these sketches, David Tell. I mean, we had Gilbert Gottfried, Susan Essman. We had everybody in these sketches that we were doing. And
how are you finding these people?
We produced the whole thing. We found everybody that works at this club.
All this talent, all these names you're saying are like the who's who, like comedy legends. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because you're going back 30-plus years ago, and they're not. But you had to obviously have an eye for that. And I assume having that eye for this talent was really a big part of why Caroline's has been successful. Because running a comedy club, I want to get into that. I assume so much of how you're going to do in revenue is based on who the talent is. Or
yes.
No?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Right.
Of course.
Okay.
Of course.
I'm no genius, but I figured that was...
You know, we don't give it away here. Our people are professionals. They get paid a nice salary for coming here. They get paid very handsomely. And we have no problem paying people handsomely. You do the business. That's all good for all of us. And it just... You know, having the A&E show kind of gave us a national platform. So that, of course, also led to, and we moved here. I moved from the Seaport. First, we started on 8th Avenue, then to the Seaport, and then I moved here.
Okay. So
and only because we needed a bigger room.
Now, let me ask you, because you move here, Caroline's moves to Times Square, 1992, and there's a whole group of people probably don't remember what Times Square was like back, even in, you know, this was pre Giuliani and pre, you know, let's make Times Square Disneyland. Why in the world would you put a comedy club in Times Square at that time?
Because I had an inkling. I had an inkling about this was going to be the place to be. And this is the center of entertainment. Look, we have Broadway. We have the greatest people on Broadway here, the greatest creative people in this whole area. And this came available to me. And I said, I'm going to take a crack at this. And, you know, it worked out. It worked out. Look, I convinced a lot of people about how great Times Square was. And we were here way before Mickey Mouse was here.
Yes. So, I mean, you're coming in the early 90s where I would imagine, like, is the building decrepit? I mean, like, literally, there's like, if you went outside back in those days, it's like porn shops and just homeless people and drug addicts. I mean, like, this was what New York became famous for. So do you get a building that's a decrepit building? Is what happened?
This building is interesting what happened here.
So the same place.
This building was... put up on the ground of a theater that they knocked down, the Thalia Theater, which in the early days was a theatrical theater, then a movie theater. So when the landlords, the builders of this building wanted to take over this space, there was a little covenant that they had to do with have entertainment in the building, which nobody knows about but me.
Right,
I mean,
right.
That's how long the lease was.
Right.
That's how long ago I signed the lease, like in 1990 for the space.
Now I'm hoping, did you sign a very long-term lease? Because as an entrepreneur, I did.
I signed a very long lease.
See, that is genius, because I could only imagine what you'd have to pay for this place today, Times Square today. So I'm sure that has been a factor in the success of the business. Now, looking at, let's say, a comedy club and in terms of like running this business, has it been a hard business to run for you in terms of personally? Is it a lot of time? Is it a lot like... Where is your mind as an entrepreneur? What are you thinking about? Is it just ticket sales, or is it, there's got to be a host of other things?
I'm always thinking about the next thing. Actually, I think one thing I learned is that you cannot stay stagnant. You just need to be creative outside of it. I mean, you need to watch what you're doing here. Look, running this club, I have help. I have great help. I have great people between my talent director and my other partner, Andrew, between Lewis and Andrew. And we run, the three of us run this whole business here. And we have so much experience in the live event space. And Lewis and I have been in the comedy business together over
How'd you meet your partners? How'd you meet these guys? Have they been there since day one?
Lewis came to work here probably over 20 years ago, and Andrew also 20 years ago. And, you know, we just taken this business, and then we've taken this business to the festival business.
Right.
So we take what we know on a larger level.
Right.
And that's what we've been doing constantly. We take what we know, and we try to put that expertise on knowing what sells, because that's what we do know what sells, and we do know what's good, because we tested it out here.
Yeah.
So we know how we can take it to the next level. And it gave me an opportunity to work with a lot of people that kind of graduated from Caroline's and now did theaters.
It seems like everyone graduated from, I mean, like all the big stars, if I looked at the list, and like I said, I mean, like the names on there that are the biggest names in comedy today. And I want to get into how you, in 2004, you know, looked and created this festival and why. But I want to go back just quickly to being a female in this business, and especially because I know there's a stigma or there's not been enough opportunities for female comics. So what happened? Who was like some of your first big female comics? Who did you give those opportunities to? And did they get a fair shake from the audience early on?
I think they got a fair shake. I think one of the first women I hired was Sandra Bernhardt. And, you know, Sandra had the movie. She was coming off of King of Comedy, and brought her into the club. And Sandra, I worked with Sandra for a lot of years. I'm still friendly with Sandra, and we communicate a lot. She was Elaine Boozler, Rita Rudner, Carol Leifer. There weren't that many young women working at that time. Look, right now there are many, many young women that have gone into this. I know that I have assistants in the office now that graduated these Ivy League schools, and they all want to be in the comedy business.
Isn't that amazing?
I think their parents want to shoot themselves.
After paying $400,000 to go to Princeton, I'd like to work.
I'd like to be a stand-up. I'd like to work in the office in the basement.
Yeah, they're going to say sit down.
But you learn a lot here. You do learn a lot about what works. Yeah.
So these women that started out initially and putting them on stage and you running this as a woman, were there other challenges? And like, do you remember like instances, or was it really, you seem like a person who put your head down and it's like, no matter what, I don't care, I'm going to like do this. But like, there had to be situations you encountered that it's hard enough to run a business, but being a female in the comedy space, I think back like that. There instances?
Look, I tried to work with the best of the talent. And sure, there were lots of women around. And I really tried my hardest. Look, I was able to put Joy Behar on stage. I was able to Susie Essman on stage early on. When Richard Belzer came to me and he said, she's my opening act. Is that okay? And I said, sure. And that's how we started working with Susie. So through the years, I mean, I love working with the women. And be quite honest with you, it's not that I don't relate to all of the male comedy, but I relate a lot better to females. So
why do you think that? I mean, is it just...
Because we think alike.
That's right. Men are from Venus. What is that?
They're getting a lot better. They're getting a lot better on stage, though. But there's just more of a relatability to it.
Sure.
I think.
Sure. So let's go back to 2004. And you always said what I've noticed, and I truly believe in being an entrepreneur, is like, you got to always think ahead and what you're going to do next and how you're going to reinvent the business, or someone in my mind is going to catch you. So was that the moment you came up with the New York Comedy Festival?
Yeah, well, this is what happened. We had a 20th anniversary of Caroline's at Carnegie Hall, and it was so much fun to bring everybody back and work with them. And I had a lot of friends and said, oh my God, we had such a fabulous night. Why don't you do more of this? So in our minds, we said, okay, let's create this festival. Let's get into the festival business. Look, who's better to do it than people that do it 365 days a year? Run a festival. Okay. There are a lot of promoters out there. There are lots of promoters out there that don't know what sells, overpay talent, and do all of that.
Oh, yeah. I know a lot of them.
we know what we are doing. So I said, who better than us to do this? So between the three of us, we put together this festival, and it's been going strong since day one.
Right. So how does that?
Of course, over the years, we've added many more layers to it. Right now, we're close to, I think last year we did 170 shows around the city, and this year will be close to that or more.
Wow.
And bigger and bigger and bigger, so.
Right. Now, you have a way about you where you kind of are like, you make it really seem like, it was no big deal. Caroline's, and like, we just started a comedy festival that's now going to be its 15th year, and it's selling out, you know, like, but there has to be, I know I'm an entrepreneur, you're an entrepreneur, like, was there a grind when you started that? Were you working 24/7? Like, give me your, what was Caroline's life like?
Okay, so I started the club. I was there answering the phones, returning phone calls on the answering machine. Remember those?
Of course.
They'd leave a message and I'd call them back. I was there booking talent. I was there paying bills. Okay. I was there when liquor was ordered. I was there. I was on the phone, and I had a nice education about wine with a great distributor of wine at that time, and he used to teach me about wine. So it was learning process all around. I learned by the seat of my pants, but I learned how to market, and I learned how to promote because I had to. And I have worked with so many PR firms in 35 years. It's that's like my forte is doing press and PR.
Yes,
so
thank you for doing this podcast.
Everything I've learned.
Hopefully someone will listen to it. Okay, so that's more like, I mean,
and I had to stuff it down everybody's throat because nobody reviewed comedy. No one.
So what do you mean? No one.
The New York Times, I had to convince Stephen Holden. And how that came about was Stephen Holden was calling me about some talent we had.
Stephen Holden, big Times critic?
Yes, right. Stephen Holden. So Stephen Holden had called me about somebody at the club. When we had cabaret acts, Stephen used to come in. He called me and he said, what is this with this talent that you're booking all the time, these young comics? And he gets me on the phone and he goes, oh, you know, I think this is more about your club than about the people that you're booking there. And that kind of, I had this great article in the New York Times, I think it was in early 1895. And it was
1895. You look a lot better than that, I'll tell you that. And I know there wasn't not too much comedy back then.
1985, okay. Stephen wrote this piece about the club. And that kind of set a lot of wheels in motion. But I had to convince people about it. Hank Gallo, who wrote for the Daily News.
Yeah, of course.
Loved comedy. And that he would come in and review it. And he'd do this pick every week. And we'd always be in the picks of what was happening in New York to go see shows. And you have to remember that these were, you know, these were people in their 30s that were going out. And it was the first grown-up nightclub. I think Bob Morton, who was the host of Bob Morton, that was a producer on David Letterman's show, said, it's the first yuppie nightclub in New York because it was like young people went to it. They saw people they related to.
And that was really what you saw. You were saying the cabaret was an older crowd. You were in your 20s and you're thinking, what would I enjoy? And assuming at that time there wasn't anything else like that, and you guys started doing it, and then the people just started coming and enjoying it. And, you know, to me, it's amazing that you look back and you're like, they didn't even want to do a critique on Jay Leno or David Letterman. And these people then, out of comedy, it seems like, have become the biggest stars in television and movies.
It's unbelievable. I remember having a conversation once with Tim Allen's manager, who I knew from way back. I mean, I work with Tim way, way back. And he says, Carolina couldn't be any better. We have the number one movie, Toy Story, number one TV show, and the number one book out. So that was pretty, you know, I've worked with the greatest talent in the world. And I learned a lot from watching all that talent over the years.
More from our guest, but first, a word from our sponsors. When we speak with successful entrepreneurs and hear their stories on how success happens, one thing that I have always found so important to success is persistence and believing in what you do. It's a sense of purpose and internal drive to make a change in a particular place. Persistence, I believe, it's the engine behind every successful entrepreneur. But entrepreneurs also have to have vision. You need to be able to imagine a better world. Forward thinking is an essential part of this. Avoid taking for granted existing things or status quo assumptions, as these can restrict broader thinking. Visualize the world without these preconceived boundaries to see the possibilities of a better way. And today, the University of Bath is able to help you on your road to success. They offer a 100% online MSc Entrepreneurship Management and Innovation course, which blurs the lines between traditional business disciplines, helps you to see business as one interconnected whole. The big picture approach will empower you to reflect upon challenges in new and innovative ways beyond established siloed thinking. It's an amazing opportunity to educate yourself further as an entrepreneur. All you need to do to get started is visit online.bath.ac.uk/entrepreneur to find out more about their online MSc Entrepreneurship Management and Innovation course. Again, that's online.bath.ac.uk/entrepreneur. And our next sponsor, How Success Happens. It's the name of this podcast, but it also describes the process of starting a business with the goal of helping people live happier, healthier lives. I'm talking about MindBody. For almost 20 years, they've been linking hundreds of thousands of passionate health, wellness, and beauty professionals to the millions of clients they serve. MindBody understands that taking care of yourself means something different for everyone. And that's why they're committed to connecting millions of customers to a huge selection of local fitness classes, massage and acupuncture, salons and spas, and they find, book, and pay all in one app. You can partner with them by listing your business at mindbodyonline.com/success. MindBody, the solution to grow and manage every detail of your business and customer experience. MindBodyOnline.com/success. And we're back. Okay, well, let me ask you this about talent, because you have seen a lot of people come through the doors, really at kind of the start of their careers. I mean, I'm talking about this A-list talent that you seem, you know all of them. Have you had situations where They get big heads. They don't want to come back. They want to charge you. Their rate is a lot higher. Like, give me, who is it? Who's doing that?
I can't say who the troublemakers are, but look, everybody's looking out to make more and more money. And that's fine when you graduate. Listen, some people get big heads and think they're bigger than what they are. And when they think they're bigger than what they were, I won't work with them again. So I won't take them to the next level. So, you know, it's nice we work with people that come to this club and we know that now they're ready to play a town hall or the Beacon and we produce them in the festival. So, you know, I get a chance to work with all the talent that I love working with here, kind of graduate the room and we can work on with them. But you can say that about probably any part of the entertainment business. I mean, people feed off their celebrity and it's...
And how much do you think from seeing these comics, and obviously you have an eye for it, they have to be pretty good, but I assume some of it, if you look at comics, and some of it has to be luck. The fact, meaning luck, they... You put them on stage here, and then all of a sudden, they got a TV show. And I mean, you could have put someone else on stage, maybe, who may have... I mean, there's so much talent. Like, just I look in New York City alone, and like, we're here on Broadway, off-Broadway actors and actresses. And like, is the line... Is it a big difference between, you think, all these people who've made it and maybe some of the ones that are just kind of struggling a little bit, but they're funny?
I think that... You know, because we watch so many people here. I think that when you really have that... special something, it works out for you. I really do. But there's a lot of things that you have to do. You have to be hardworking. You have to write material all the time. You can't go on that stage and do the same jokes all the time. You have to have new material every time you come in. If you headline this room, you have to have new material to come into this room. You can't do the same show again. You could do some of the stuff that, look, I'm one that laughs at the same joke all the time. So I love some of those great jokes. I love that. But the audience expects a new show. You have to have tenacity. You have to go out there and practice lots of times. You have to have new material. It's hard work. It's not easy to write a joke. It's not easy.
You must always have to be thinking and on. And yeah, I've been to enough comedy clubs. And don't hate me for saying this. I live on 74th Street. They opened up the West Side Comedy Club. It's on 75th Street. But a lot of those comics I notice, because I'll go back, you know, it's on my block, same routines. Like the next, and you just stop going because... You know, I don't like a joke. You know, the second time, it's not as funny.
Look, they could be working on their delivery on the joke because that takes a little finesse. You have to work that out. But here we just strive for always presenting new people to the audience.
And you've done a great job. Yeah. So let's go to 2004 because this now you Caroline's, as you said, you're doing everything. You build it up into an operation, an incredible comedy club. You start this New York Comedy Festival, right? What was that like? Was that a grind too? Were you, you know, having to get sponsors and like sell tickets and like running around during the festival? I could imagine it's probably like hectic. Or what was that like?
Well, early on, we didn't have as many shows as we have now and probably weren't, one or two shows didn't sell as well as we thought early on. But we built this up over the years because we knew we wanted to work with the people that worked here. We did have sponsors. We were able to have sponsors. You know, we had Mercedes as a sponsor. We had ABC.
Yeah, did they just come to you or like you have to like pound the pavement?
We worked on it. We had connections.
I know you're a worker, though.
We worked on it.
I could tell.
We worked on it. We had ABC as an early sponsor. We had Comedy Central as a sponsor. We had TBS as a sponsor last year. We've had Citibank for a number of years here. These are our constant sponsors. And this is what the sponsors love about it. They really can connect to their customer. When Mercedes was here with a car company, take them for test drives, put the car outside. Sure. Everybody gets to see your car as they go into Carnegie Hall.
The activations. And the thing to remember, too, with a festival like this is everyone's in a good mood. So they're coming out. And you know what? Maybe the difference between doing a test drive at a comedy event as opposed to like a wrestling match or a sporting event that your team loses, everyone's laughing. Mm-hmm. Everyone's happy. So I would imagine like, for sponsorship, it's really a win-win.
It's really a way to touch a customer, especially since you have to buy your ticket with a credit card. So you're touching the customer there. Then we go again into drinks, beers and liquors and whatever. You are absolutely there with the customer having a good time with your product. So that means a lot to a customer. So we're able to connect with what the brands want. And then we connect with influencers that can even talk about it even more.
Now, who are influencers in the comedy space? Are those comedians themselves?
They're comedians themselves that will get behind a product and do it. I mean, I had a young woman here. Her name was Michelle Wolf, who then went on to do the Correspondents' Dinner and then Clark Claim to Fame. She's a wonderful stand-up, really wonderful. We had her doing a little product here with a dog treat, and she was behind the stage in the dressing room and interviewing comedians about the dog treat, which was hilarious.
Right.
It was a little pop-up
gig. Was this like her first gig? Or like,
oh, yeah, this many years ago.
That's amazing.
So we were able to engage great talent early on because we know what's going
to
happen.
You put them to work.
We put them to work.
Selling dog treats. That's amazing.
Well, it was, and you really
have an eye for
it. It was Instagram
talent.
It was on Instagram.
Well,
it was all
the
over the place. And it was out, and it was wonderful dog treat by Purina. And you clicked it, and the dog went up and he grabbed it. You know, it was like, so it was great. So we do that.
Right.
We do that with sponsors.
So you've really done that, and that really has only had to have been maybe the last few years with social media.
Mm-hmm.
How did the festival build up, let's say, when it started in 04 to become what it is today? Was there a lot of labor involved in terms of getting to the point where, you know, it's become what it is today? Like, were there any key moments that really kind of turned it around? Big performances?
Well, we had big performances. We produced Kevin Hart at Madison Square Garden, which then was made into a movie about
that. It was part of the festival, and then you actually produced it as a standalone.
It was a standalone movie that he distributed. Mm-hmm. We did two shows at Madison Square Garden with him. We did a lot of shows at Madison. We did Dane Cook at Madison Square Garden. We did, just last year, Bill Burr at Madison Square Garden. We have another big garden event this year, which I can't talk about yet because we haven't announced any of that yet.
When will the announcements take place?
That announcement happens beginning of August.
Sure.
Yeah. We announce everything going on. It's our first announcement for the festival. We do two or three announcements.
Okay.
We do the big, big shows. Then we do Stand Up for Heroes, then we do other shows in between all of that. You know, as we're cooking all this stuff, because it takes a long time to put it all to bed.
Yeah. How are you plan? Like, do you plan that out during the year, just in terms of finding the comics? And like, how do you get better each year? Because I've seen some of the acts and like what you're talking about, and like that, like, how do you keep topping it?
Well, it's good that every year there's another face becomes a little more popular than the last. So we work on that. We work on who we worked with here at the club, and we know where we can take them after that. And somebody has a hit movie, hit TV show, we work with that. But we start working on this about a month after the festival finishes in November. You know, in December, we start talking about what we want to do. And look, even people that we didn't work with this year say, next year, let's plan to do this because I'm not touring this year. So we'll work on that.
And
so
everyone's got to know you in this business.
They know us. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No, they know you. You're Caroline.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, you know, the other part of what's happened with the whole brand movement now is that people come to me here, while we're talking about brands, to produce shows for them that they could use for product placement on social media. Mm. So I have done, like, I did a great show here many years ago for CoverGirl, where I presented them with all young female comedians. And in that, they probably don't even know, they had Amy Schumer in that whole mix of people there.
Incredible.
And then this year I did another night here for a cosmetic line and healthcare line that was coming out for women. So I put that whole thing together that they could use online for a launch of a brand.
And how does that work? So the brand will come to you and ask, you know, you're basically like a production company.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do they get to use your talent or the talent that's performing here? Or how does that work?
No,
do they have to pay for it? Or
they come to me with an idea and I say, no, this is how it's got to work. I said, this is how it works. It goes, I get you the talent that I think is appropriate for you and you sign off. I know what will work for this particular product that you want to do. So you have to sign off with, you're also taking a lot of their material and then you're putting it out there so that you kind of own it for a while.
Right.
So the talent needs to be paid appropriately.
Sure.
So I work all of that out. I'm like the ad agency.
I'm like the ad agency.
I'm right here.
You're selling, you're incorporating, you're packaging, you're putting it out there. But I think that's a really big trend that's happening nowadays where you have brands that are starting their own festivals, that are starting to create their own narrative and their own events and their own doing packaged content like you're talking about. That's where things are going because, as we know, traditional advertising just doesn't work in a world where you have Netflix and Hulu and you don't need to really watch ads. Now it's the brand really needs to own it. And I think that sits well for you. So I know you said that you're always looking around for the next thing. You don't want anyone to eat your lunch. So is that part of your next initiative, or what are some things that you're working on?
Yeah, the producing part of it is that I really love that. I love to make something that, you know, works. So I'm taking my knowledge of knowing when I come into the room and people are laughing, I know what hits a nerve. So I know that kind of part of it. And then I've gone on now and we've started another division here with Caroline's Entertainment. We're going out and producing comedies, movies.
Oh, wow.
So we're doing a lot of that.
So have you done anything? Did that start? Is that new?
Well, that's new. It's one little movie that he did. It's not a comedy. It's a serious movie about a group of women at the University of Chicago in the late 60s who helped their classmates get safe abortions.
This is a true story.
It's called it was about the Jane Collective, and it was a group of women that went to the University of Chicago.
Now, how do you start? You know, Caroline's, I'm thinking it's going to be funny. The least funny. You know,
it's the least funny. I've got another project too that's not funny either, but it's meaningful. This is a very meaningful project.
So a lot of these projects and the things you're looking to do, I mean, more personal, like you want to tell stories.
I want to tell stories. Yeah.
What's the other one?
The other one is I'm working on I could talk about. Okay. Well, it's about anti-Semitism. And that's with a major broadcaster.
Certainly relevant today.
Yes. And then we're producing a documentary for Comedy Central called What a Mother. And it's about comedians and their mothers.
Okay, there you go. That's funny.
And then I have other books optioned and satires and whatever. We're working on all of that.
So you've really kind of built up this comedy empire.
We'll try.
And what's your vision for you for the next several years? Are you enjoying the day-to-day? It really seems like
I enjoy the saying to everybody that this is really good. You need to do this. That's what I enjoy about it. I, you know, find something that's amusing or I think that will sell and then going out and trying to make it. It's a challenge, but it stretches you.
Yeah. So okay, going back to my little thing here, not so little, but on women and females and comedy, what has changed today for young comics coming up that are female? What is it that is easier or is it?
No, I think it's much easier. I think that the turning point, I was trying to figure out when everybody was trying to get involved with female comedians. Like, I've pushed it for years. I really have. I've pushed it. And I have a really good friend of mine, Carol Leifer, is a writer. She wrote on Seinfeld and she's writing on Curb now. And I've been close to her for years. But always try to stay friendly with all of my females that I met early on in here. But I think the turning point came when Tina Fey and Amy Poehler hosted the Golden Globes. And it was like, wow, those two women are really funny.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
And it was kind of a turning point. And there were a lot of young women that watched Amy and Tina on Saturday Night Live, were going to college, and then decided that I want to be a writer. I want to do that. And I think that was a real big turning point for a lot of young women. And there's so many women around. But I have to tell you, about 25 years ago, I started this. I was on the board of the Miss Foundation, and I started a comedy night. And we were kind of hard-pressed for finding women to do that comedy night every year. And now there are hundreds of women that we could get. No shortage of talent to do that show today.
Yeah.
So
no,
that's
great.
How things have changed.
Well, that's great.
Lots of young women going into this business.
Yeah, as comedians or
comedians,
more writers?
Writers, producers. I mean, it's got to start. Comedies have to start in the brain. I mean, you have to have that special touch and the special way that you look at things to be a comedy writer.
Yeah.
But more and more and more.
And how you've what is it that gives you that knack to go back to it? Like finding these, like knowing they're going to be funny. Like you hire Jon Stewart at 28. Like, how do you know?
You just.
Is it like your magical power?
Because if you sat in the room, you would know. You know what works. You know how the audience reacts. I have it firsthand here before anybody else does. I know what's going to work on TV because I know the characters. I just know who's going to have it. Who's going to have that extra oomph on TV.
Yeah.
You know, I was wondering about, you know, I was a big fan of all the Norman Lear shows, you know?
Oh, sure.
And I was watching
Did you watch the live ones?
Well, the thing is, I know every episode of The Jeffersons, so, which
such
is great.
A classic.
And you go back and I look at it, and, you know, you wonder about some of the sitcoms today, but The Jeffersons were so groundbreaking. Not only that it was a black family that lived uptown, but it was just that the characters on there and the actors and actresses were so fabulous. And lots of times in our sitcoms today, we don't have that.
Yeah.
And that's part of why they don't work half the time.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you had Sherman Hemsley, who was like,
did he ever perform? Did he perform
did.
There?
He did. Yeah. Years later, a few years before he passed away, yeah. He was here at Caroline's. Yeah.
So yeah, when you
got to meet all of these people that, you know, I watched on TV, and I just started watching the Jeffersons again.
Right.
And then when Jimmy Kimmel announced that he was producing this, it was like, oh my God. And I do know Norman. So yeah. It was like, oh my God.
Well, I didn't think it was going to be, I was so skeptical, and I watched both, you know, episodes of the Jeffersons and All in the Family. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is hilarious. I wanted them, you know, to do more episodes. And I was kind of blown away, too, just by how groundbreaking it was back then with the language. And there's certain things they would never say on TV now that were part of those shows. And that's really interesting. Mm-hmm.
So, they did break ground on all of those shows. It was great.
So who's some of your favorite? Like, I know you're not going to give me who, you know, is coming back and wanting to charge an arm and a leg, but who have been some of the favorite comics of yours who've really come back and just been really genuine and like understood this is where they started?
Well, you know who we had here? I was just bringing back some things that we did in the festival. We had Russell Peters, who's mega, does big venues, and came here and did a weekend run here during the festival. And it was so much fun to have him and to watch the audience just react with him. And, you know, when he plays like arenas. And here comes and plays a room for 300 people. It was so much fun. Jabuki Young White, who's a very new comedian right now, and was on The Daily Show, mm-hmm. was here a few months ago. And he had a wonderful audience that came out to see him. So we love presenting the big acts and the people that are just starting out. And what happens here is when you do play Caroline's and you do sell out, agents and managers take that to the next level for around the country.
Oh, I'm sure.
So that happens.
So you get a lot of agents and potential agents and managers in the audience. Mm-hmm. There, you must know.
Bill Burr started here, and then last year it's produced him at Madison Square Garden. And, you know, he is just so, he just always has the newest material. He's so prolific.
Yeah.
He's just unbelievable and right on the spot and just so on the spot. I mean, that's the brilliance of comedy.
Yeah.
To perform like he does. So.
Who are some of your personal favorites?
Personal.
Let me ask you, I should ask you this right at the beginning, but like, are you a comedian? Like, do you like comedy?
J.B. Smooth was just here.
J.B.
I mean, it's like, you know, J.B. worked here also when he was a writer on Saturday Night Live many, many years ago. And I watched him here about 2 weeks ago, and I was on the floor laughing with him. I get a kick of coming into the room and watching everybody.
But so. You're not, you like watching comedy, not actually performing.
No, I don't perform.
Okay.
No.
This is the most I'm going to get from you, this podcast. So that's great. And I think, you know, just in terms of everything going forward, you have the festival. It's going to be, can you give me the dates and a little rundown and where people might be able to?
It's November 4th. Okay. 10th. It's New York City. It'll be announced in the beginning of August, and all the shows will be announced. And we kind of reach everybody around the country with that. And just stay tuned. Just get your tickets early, because we do sell out really quickly.
You better get your tickets early.
We do. We sell out
this thing
so
is
quickly.
Blowing up.
And then watch for all of our little shows around the city. We'll be doing, oh my goodness, probably close to 150 shows around the city.
Wow.
Small ones, which all lead to something else.
Wow. That should be fun. Well, mm-hmm. listen, Caroline, thank you so much for coming on. I actually have got the chance to sit in like Caroline's, which is, as I've said, iconic. I'm probably maybe the only person that sat here and got to hear you perform as opposed to Seinfeld or someone like that. So thank you. And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuckman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.